Hi everybody, I'm Mark Amadeo, Principal of the Amadeo Law Firm, and I want to thank everyone for joining us today for our webinar covering the cybersecurity rules under FAR and DFARS. Now, before we get started, I just want to say a few words about me and my law firm. So I've been practicing for over 20 years and am the founder of the Amadeo Law Firm. And the firm has locations in Washington, D.C., and in Maryland, and its primary focus is on federal government contracting. So we help clients with all of their government contracting legal needs, and that includes preparing and negotiating teaming, subcontract and joint venture agreements with their teaming partners, providing advice on FAR and DFARS compliance, advising clients during post-award negotiations with contracting officers, and helping our technology clients to protect their valuable technology in their dealings with the government and with their private sector collaborators. So we'll provide you with my contact information at the end of the presentation. And if you have any questions on any of the information that I'm presenting today, feel free to reach out to me after the presentation. So today we're going to give an outline of the cybersecurity rules under FAR and DFARS for protecting unclassified information. And we're focusing on unclassified information since the cybersecurity rules on unclassified information are the ones that have the widest coverage and are the ones that contractors are most likely to run into and have to comply with. Now, I don't think there's any serious doubt that the US government over the last 5 or 10 years has increasingly faced persistent, sustained, and sophisticated attacks on its information systems. And in fact, just about a month ago, in February 2023, the U.S. Marshals Service suffered a major security breach after hackers broke into its systems and stole data that included information about investigative targets and about its employees. And we know that foreign adversaries like Russia, China, and North Korea, to name a few, we know that they sponsor and fund sophisticated hacking networks that have successfully set their sights on both government and commercial targets here in the US. So in the face of all of this activity from all these bad actors, we have, at least so far, a patchwork, or really layers of sometimes overlapping security blankets that protect the US's commercial and government IT infrastructure. And as time goes on, I think we're going to see the threads of those security blankets get woven tighter and tighter. But for today, we're going to focus on the rules under FAR and DFARS that are in place right now, that are aimed at protecting the government contractor information systems from these cyber threats. So right now there are three sets of cybersecurity rules under FAR and DFARS that apply to federal government contractors. And the first set of rules are basic safeguarding rules under FAR. And these rules require contractors to comply with 15 separate security requirements that we'll touch on in a few minutes. And since the rules under FAR are generally applicable to all federal government contractors, these basic safeguarding rules apply to both civilian and defense agency contractors. Next are additional security requirements under DFARS that DoD contractors have to comply with. And there are three groups of requirements that DoD contractors have to meet under these rules. First, they have to provide adequate security over their information systems. And second, they have to comply with rules that require them to take certain actions in response to cyber incident and malicious software intrusions. And then lastly, DoD contractors have to have assessments performed of their compliance with the security requirements that are set out in the National Institute of Standards and Technology's Special Publication 800-171. Now, lastly, the last group of cybersecurity requirements are verification requirements under the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification Program, that was unveiled by DoD in 2019. Now, these requirements haven't been fully implemented in DFARS, but the implementing regulations are expected to be released sometime this year, perhaps in May or June. And the CMMC requirements are expected to require DoD contractors to submit as a condition of a contract award a certification of their compliance with both the basic FAR safeguarding requirements and additional DFARS safeguarding requirements. Now, if I had to guess, I would say that an overwhelming majority, if not most federal government contractors, are subject to at least some of these cybersecurity rules under contracts that are currently in place. And if they aren't now, they likely will be in government contracts that they perform under in the future. So that chart up there is a very general checklist of the cybersecurity rules that all government contractors should familiarize themselves with. So for the rest of the presentation, we're going to take a closer look at the three sets of cybersecurity rules, and we'll start with the basic safeguarding rules in FAR. Now, FAR Clause 52.204-21 is the clause that lays out the basic safeguarding requirements. And that clause is required to be inserted into all solicitations and contracts in which the contractor or any subcontractor may have federal contract information that's stored or transmitted through their systems during contract performance. Now, one thing we should notice right off the bat is that commercial contracts and contracts for commercially available off-the-shelf items are not exempted or carved out. And again, since the rules under FAR are generally applicable to all contracts, including defense contracts, contracting officers for both DoD and civilian agencies are required to insert the clause into their contracts that may involve federal contract information. So if 52.204-21 is in a contract, what triggers the safeguarding requirements is if the contractor has a covered contractor information system. And a covered contractor information system under FAR is an information system that processes, stores, or transmits federal contract information. Now, federal contract information in turn is information that's not intended for public release, that's provided by the government or generated for the government under a government contract. But it doesn't include information that's provided by the government to the public or simple transactional information, things like payment processing information. So the definition of federal contract information is pretty broad. Basically, any non-public information that's provided by the government to the contractor or non-public information that's generated by the contractor during contract performance. So given the broad definition, you'd be hard-pressed to find a government contract in which federal contract information is not generated or handled by a contractor. And so contractors should generally expect to find FAR Clause 52.204-21 in the solicitations they've been under and in the contracts that they are awarded. So if a government contractor is going to have federal contract information on an information system during contract performance, it's going to have to apply the 15 safeguards that are listed up here on this slide. Now, we won't go through each of them here, but as you scan through the list, you can see that a number of these require limits on access to the systems, both physical and electronic limits. Now, another requires a firewall between internal and external or public-facing networks. And then other requirements include malicious code or malware protections. So a few points before we move on. The 15 basic safeguarding requirements don't seem like much, and especially compared to the 110 NIST SB 800-171 requirements that DoD contractors have to comply with under DFARS. And we'll touch on those in a few minutes. But contractors have to remember that these are day one requirements. So if there are any of these safeguards that are not in place, it may take time to resource the requirement with additional staff or software or hardware. So contractors should make sure that they're in compliance well before contract performance begins. And then secondly, unlike DFARS, under FAR there is no verification process to make sure that contractors are compliant with the safeguarding rules. Instead, by signing the contract, contractors are representing that they're in compliance with the 15 requirements. Now, given the increasingly heightened awareness to cyber threats and the trend, at least on the DoD side of things, of requiring verification of compliance, should we anticipate that this will change at some point? Well, in my view, absolutely. I think it's only a matter of time before the rules under FAR require some sort of verification of compliance. So civilian agency contractors should not only be implementing the safeguards, they should also be tracking and documenting their compliance with each of the safeguards in a way that lets them correlate any system changes to the requirements in FAR. So the next set of requirements we'll explore are additional safeguarding requirements on DoD contractors under DFARS. And those requirements are set out in the four DFARS clauses that are listed up there on the slide, two of which are required to be inserted into all DoD solicitations, and two of which are required to be inserted into all DoD solicitations and contracts. And the only exception for each of these clauses are solicitations or contracts for commercially available off-the-shelf items. So as under FAR, what triggers the safeguarding requirements under each of the DFARS clauses is if the contractor has a covered contractor information system. But under DFARS, a covered contractor information system is defined as an information system that processes, stores, or transmits covered defense information, as opposed to federal contract information. So let's talk a little bit more about covered defense information. So under DFARS, there are two categories of information that's considered covered defense information, or CDI. There's unclassified controlled technical information, or CTI, and then there's information that's identified as controlled unclassified information on a registry that's maintained by the National Archives, or CUI. So in either case, if the information is provided by DoD to the contractor for contract performance, it must be marked or identified in the contract to be considered covered defense information. But covered defense information also includes any CUI or CTI that a contractor handles or stores or develops during contract performance. And this last point is important because there may be a perception among contractors that covered defense information has to be generated by or originated from the government, and that's just not the case. So taking a closer look at that first category of information, controlled technical information, or CTI, DFARS defines controlled technical information as technical information with a military or space application that is subject to restrictions on use or access or disclosure. And DFARS defines technical information to mean technical data or computer software as defined under 252.227-7013. And technical data under that clause is defined pretty broadly to include any written or recorded information that's of a scientific or technical nature. So getting back to the definition of controlled technical information, and again, we're talking technical information with a military or space application that's restricted in some way. Well, the definition then adds what may be an awkwardly worded qualifier, It says that controlled technical information would meet the criteria for certain kinds of distribution statements under a DoD instruction. And we'll touch on that instruction a little bit more in a few minutes, but generally speaking, that DoD instruction limits the government's public disclosure of certain kinds of information and requires distribution statements to accompany the information when it's shared within the government. So one way you can read this additional statement is that CTI is restricted technical information that also must fall within one of the categories of information under that DoD instruction that requires a distribution statement prior to circulation within the government. But if that were the proper reading, the definition would just say CTI is technical data with a military or space application that's subject to a distribution statement under the DoD instruction, and you wouldn't need the rest of the definition. So an alternative reading, and I think one that makes more sense, is that the reference to the DoD instruction is merely intended to notify contractors that CTI may typically, but isn't necessarily limited to the kind of information that is subject to a distribution statement under the DoD instruction. Now, unfortunately, DoD kind of declined to provide much clarification during the comment period for the rule that added this language to the regulation. So two more points here. First, if the information is made public without restriction, then it drops out of the definition of CTI. And second, there's a DFARS clause at 252.204-7000 that DoD can insert into contracts in which a contractor may have access to unclassified information that's sensitive and not appropriate for public release. And under that clause, a contractor is generally prohibited from releasing any information about the contract publicly. So in those contracts where that clause is inserted, all data is subject to restrictions. And if any of it relates to a military or space application, that data may be CTI. And this is maybe one of those instances in which technical data is CTI, but it may not fall within one of the distribution statement categories that are in the DoD instruction. So again, DoD instruction 5230.24 lays out the guidelines for how DoD is supposed to handle technical information that's created, revised, or used in connection with a DoD acquisition or activity. And there are certain categories of technical information that DoD instructs should only be circulated within the government. And under the instruction, that restricted information is supposed to be marked with a particular distribution statement, depending on who within the government gets to see the information. So we don't have time to go through each of the categories, but you can see that includes categories for information related to export-controlled information, critical technology, and proprietary information. And so this last category for proprietary information broadly includes proprietary business information, including information about background IP that a contractor might bring in under a DoD contract and that might be subject to the government's restricted or limited data rights. So earlier this year, DoD revised instruction 5230.24 and gave it a new title. Now, the DFARS definition of CTI still refers to the old title, but I'm sure at some point the regulations will be revised to refer to the new title of the instruction. And so contractors may see the DFARS clauses inserted in their contracts that refer to the newly revised instruction. Now, most of the old categories are still there, but under this revised instruction, there is now a category for CTI, which has the same definition in the instruction as in the regulation. And they also added a separate category for SBIR data and a new category for information related to international agreements. Now, the second kind of information that may be considered covered defense information is information that requires safeguarding or controls under a law or regulation or government policy, and that falls under one of the categories that are considered controlled unclassified information by the National Archives. So as the official repository for government information, the National Archives is responsible for maintaining a registry that identifies what information is controlled or restricted from dissemination under U.S. laws or regulations or policies. And that COI registry is available online, and it identifies 20 groupings, and then within those groupings, 125 categories of information that's COI. And we've listed just a few of the groupings and categories up there on the slide. Now, the nice thing about the COI registry is that in addition to providing a brief description of the information that falls within each category, it also lists the particular law or regulation that puts limits on how that information can be disseminated. So just a few more points here. As you can see, some of the categories under CUI overlap with the categories of CTI that we looked at earlier. Now, although there may be some overlap between the two, CUI covers a much wider array of information. So not only are there a larger number of categories, but also CUI isn't limited to information with the military or space application like CTI is. And so between the two categories that are CTI and that are CUI, the kind of information that the DoD safeguarding requirements apply to is pretty broad, and it's not limited to critical technology or military information. So DoD contractors and particularly small businesses that perhaps are new to the DoD marketplace, they should review their expected workflow and their contract deliverables, and then carefully examine the categories of information that are CUI or CTI before drawing any conclusions about whether they are required to comply with the DFARS safeguarding rules. Now, I make this point because, as we'll see in a few minutes, there's an ongoing trend to require DoD contractors to verify or prove that they're actually complying with the cybersecurity rules. And this trend is born, at least in part, out of DoD's conclusion that a number of contractors are not in compliance. And to the extent there are contractors that are not yet in compliance, I suspect the reasons, at least some of the reasons may be, that the contractors are assuming that the information that triggers the safeguarding requirements is narrower than its actual scope under the regulations. So assuming that a contractor has a covered contractor information system, and again meaning that the contractor has covered defense information, which is either CTI or CUI that's generated or handled or stored by the contractor during contract performance. So assuming the triggering condition is met, well, as we mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, the contractor is going to have to meet three groups of security requirements. So first, the contractor is going to have to provide adequate security on all covered contractor information systems. Now, some contractors may have multiple or separate covered contractor information systems. For example, a contractor that works on site at a government facility or manages a government IT system might have a covered information system that resides on a government operating system. And it may also have a covered information system back at the home office that has, for example, technical specifications that cover the government systems or the job site that it's working on. And the safeguarding requirements apply to each covered contractor information system that a contractor has. So in the case of a DoD contractor that has information on a system that's operated by the government, the adequate security requirements are going to be specified in the contract. Now, if the government information system with the contractor's covered information is in connection with cloud computing services that the contractor provides to the government, the contractor also has to comply with all the requirements that apply to service providers that offer cloud computing services to the government. And those requirements are in DFARS 252.239-7010. And they're fairly extensive, and we don't have time to go into them in any detail here, but they include meeting the requirements in DoD's Cloud Computing Security Requirements Guide. They also include limiting access to data and cyber incident reporting. So in the case of a DoD contractor that has covered defense information on its own systems, or on a system that isn't operated by the government, and I think most DoD contractors with covered defense information are going to fall into this category, especially small businesses. Well, in that instance, adequate security at a minimum includes implementation of all 110 security requirements that are contained in NIST SP 800-171. Unless DoD has determined that a requirement doesn't apply or it approves a variation of the requirement. Now, for a contractor that has its covered defense information on the cloud, to provide adequate security means that the contractor will have to make sure that its service provider is FedRAMP compliant. And then lastly, if a contractor provides a unique service or has special circumstances, and the DFARS regulation provides the case of a contractor that uses medical devices as an example. Well, in that case, to provide adequate security means that the contractor may have to implement additional security measures to protect the information that may be uniquely stored or generated or transmitted. So let's take a closer look at NIST SP 800-171 implementation requirement. So stepping back, the National Institute of Standards and Technology issued its special publication 800-171 in order to provide federal government agencies with recommendations on how to protect unclassified covered information when that information resides in systems that are not operated by the government. And so SP 800-171 sets out 14 groups or families of requirements. So for example, one family focuses on access control, another focuses on incident response, and another family focuses on physical protection. And then spread out among the 14 families are 110 separate and specific recommended security requirements. So the DFARS regulation at 252.204-7012 requires full implementation of the SP 800-171 security requirements, and that can seem fairly daunting. But in several DoD memos and in the SP 800-171 itself, contractors are instructed that they can demonstrate implementation of SP 800-171 with a system security plan that identifies which security requirements have been met, along with plans of action for those requirements that have not yet been met. So a system security plan is a document that basically provides a snapshot of an information system as of the date of the plan. And it also provides some background information about a system, including the system's operating environment, system boundaries, and its connection to other systems. But it also describes the security requirements that have been met. Now, plans of action describe how and when any unimplemented requirements are going to be met. And they typically include milestones with interim completion dates. So this slide provides an example of one of the security requirements in NIST SP 800-171. So on the left is an excerpt from the publication for requirement 3.1.1, which requires system access to be limited to authorized users, processes, and devices. And on the right is an excerpt from a companion publication that NIST issued, and that's NIST SP 800-171A. And that publication provides guidance to federal agencies on how to assess whether or not security requirements have been implemented. So, for example, in the case of requirement 3.1.1, NIST SP 800-171A provides suggestions on the kind of information that should be examined, the personnel that should be interviewed, and tests that can confirm implementation of the requirement. So besides the adequate security measures that we just went over, a DoD contractor also has to comply with a group of other safeguarding requirements that center around responding to cyber incidents and malicious software intrusions. So if a contractor discovers a cyber incident that affects its covered contractor information system or the CDI that resides in it, the contractor has to conduct a review of the incident by reviewing the compromised components or data and user accounts, and then it has to report the incident to DoD on DoD's DIBNet website. Now, in order to submit its report, the contractor already needs to have a medium assurance certificate. And if it doesn't have a certificate when the incident occurs, DoD offers a hotline that a contractor can call in order to get assistance. But contractors may want to be proactive and get a medium assurance certificate as a matter of course before any incident occurs. Now, if the incident involves malicious software, the contractor needs to isolate the software and then submit it to DoD's Cyber Crime Center. And then also for up to 90 days after a contractor submits a cyber incident report, the contractor also has to preserve any images of the affected information systems, as well as any monitoring or packet capture data, in order to give DoD time to request that media. Now, if DoD requests access to information or equipment in order to conduct a forensic analysis, or if DoD decides to conduct a damage assessment, then the contractor also has to provide access to the information or equipment that DoD has requested to review. And then lastly, before a contractor submits information to DoD that includes proprietary information, it needs to identify it and then place appropriate markings on the information. So up until 2020, contractors were kind of left to themselves with regard to implementation of the SP 800-171 requirements. By signing the DoD contracts, contractors were representing that they had implemented the requirements, but there was no real verification. And again, for DoD contractors that aren't providing cloud computing services, the SP 800-171 requirements are the main requirements that they have to meet in order to demonstrate that they're providing adequate security over their systems. Well, by 2020, DoD had concluded that contractors were not implementing the requirements consistently. So in 2020, the DFARS regulations were amended to require contractors to have assessments of their compliance with SP 800-171, and then to report on those assessments to DoD. So under the DFARS clauses that are listed on the slide, as a condition for receiving a DoD award, a contractor must have a current assessment of its compliance with NIST SP 800-171 for each of its covered contractor information systems. And current means that the assessment must have been performed at least within the last 3 years. And the assessment has to follow the methodology that DoD lays out in the NIST SP-800-171 DoD assessment methodology. So there are three kinds of assessments that can be performed. There's the basic assessment that a contractor performs of its own compliance with SP-800-171. And then there are medium and high assessments that DoD performs. Now, DoD makes the decision on whether to, a medium or high assessment has to be in place, depending on how critical the program is, or depending on the sensitivity of the information that's going to be handled by the contractor. So under the regulation, a contractor's basic assessment is based on its review of its system security plan, while the medium and high assessments by the government are based on its review of additional documentation. And then in the case of high assessments, the government does a hands-on examination to see if the SSP is a true reflection of the condition of an information system. So one last point here. Now, whether it's the government or the contractor that's performing the assessment, in either case, the DoD assessment methodology says that the process for determining whether a particular security requirement has been met should follow the recommended procedures under NIST SP-800-171A. Now, we talked about those procedures earlier when we looked at the access control example. And those procedures can be fairly involved in terms of what should be reviewed, who should be interviewed, and how a system should be tested for compliance. So a few more points on the assessment requirement. Once the assessment is completed, either the government or the contractor, depending on who's conducting the assessment, has to tabulate a numerical summary level score. And that score is kind of like a grade, and it's calculated using DoD's assessment methodology. And under that methodology, contractors start off with a score of 110, and then for each requirement that hasn't been met, points are subtracted from the score. Now it's a weighted point system, so some of the requirements are worth 3 points and some are worth 5, depending on how critical or impactful the requirement is for the information system. So it's possible, depending on which requirements have not been satisfied, for a contractor to have a negative summary level score. And then lastly, once the score is tabulated, it has to be posted in DoD's Supplier Performance Risk System, along with some additional information about the contractor, the information system, and the system security plan. So the last set of cybersecurity requirements that I want to touch on briefly today are the CMMC program requirements, which have gotten a fair amount of attention lately. So in a nutshell, the CMMC program steps the cybersecurity verification requirements up a notch by requiring DoD contractors to obtain a certification of their compliance as a condition of any contract awards. Now, we're not going to get too deep into the weeds here on CMMC for several reasons. First and foremost, the implementing regulations have not even been issued yet, although there is some indication that those regulations may be issued in May or June of this year. And then secondly, to adequately cover what DoD has published about how it expects to implement the program would take up more time than we have right now. And it might be best left for a separate webinar. So I'll just give a short overview here. And again, there are no regulations covering the CMMC requirements. So all we have is based on the detailed presentations and the guidance that DoD has issued since it first announced the program was coming in the summer of 2019. And the graph up there, which was issued by DoD, does a good job of depicting the highlights of the program. So first, the expectation is that once CMMC is fully implemented, all DoD contractors are going to have to obtain a certification that they meet the cybersecurity requirements in order to be awarded a DoD contract. And the solicitation and contract will specify what level of certification a DoD contractor has to obtain in order to be awarded the contract. Now, second, the expectation is that there will be three levels of certification. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, CMMC pulls in requirements from both FAR and DFARS. So to obtain level one certification, a contractor has to meet the basic safeguarding requirements under FAR 52.204-21 that we discussed earlier. And the reason why it says 17 and not 15 on the chart is because DoD takes one of the FAR safeguarding requirements and breaks it up into three parts. To obtain level two certification, a contractor is going to have to meet the 110 safeguarding rules under NIST SP 800-171, and then to obtain level three certification, a contractor is going to have to meet those requirements and then also some set of requirements from NIST SP 800-172, which is a publication that NIST issued that sets out enhanced security requirements to be used when an information system is used under a contract that supports a critical program or a high value asset. Now, as of DoD's last guidance, it hasn't decided which of those enhanced requirements will be mandated for level three. Now, as for who makes the assessment to obtain the certification, for the basic assessment, the contractor performs the assessment, and it has to be done annually. For level two, if the information that the contractor is expected to handle is not deemed critical for national security, then the contractor can perform a self-assessment, which will have to be done annually as well. Otherwise, if the information is expected to be critical for national security, the assessment will have to be performed by a third-party assessor, and it will have to be performed at least once every 3 years. And lastly, level three is reserved for contracts supporting the most critical defense programs, and the assessment will be led by the government, and will also have to be performed at least once every 3 years. Now, while we wait for the CMMC regulations to be published, at a minimum, DoD contractors can review their system security plans to make sure that they're current and that they adequately reflect the state of their information systems. They can also try to close the gap on any NIST SP 800-171 requirements that have not been met. Because according to some of DoD's informal guidance, the expectation is that for level two certification, DoD will have a baseline number of SP 800-171 requirements that will have to be met, with a limited time frame for contractors to catch up on any unmet requirements that are on their plans of action. So just a few last thoughts. First, apart from the security protections, the FAR and DFARS clauses that we covered also impose a mandate that contractors flow down the requirements to their subcontractors. Also, as we touched on at the beginning of the presentation, but it bears repeating, it's only a matter of time before civilian agency contractors are going to have to comply with a cybersecurity preparedness verification or certification requirement as a condition of any awards. When you think about agencies like the Department of Energy, the Department of Treasury, or the Department of State, or the Social Security Administration, well, you don't have to have much of an imagination to see just how impactful a major disruption might be to the lives of everyday Americans. And then lastly, and this seems like an obvious point, contractors, particularly DoD contractors right now, contractors have to be proactive when it comes to meeting the cybersecurity requirements. And what I mean by that is that it's not enough just to practice good corporate hygiene. I mean, that's a given. But good corporate hygiene might not be enough to meet all the NIST SP 800-171 requirements. But even more than that, As we see with the SP 800-171 assessment requirements and the upcoming CMMC certification requirement, to get a foot in the door, companies are not only going to have those safeguards in place, they're also going to have to document those safeguards with the system security plan and other documentation. And that documentation is going to have to be sufficient to withstand some level of scrutiny. Now, all of this is to say that this is all going to take some time and should be hammered out well before contract signing day. Well, that's all I have for our presentation today. I want to thank everyone for listening in. And I know we've covered a lot of territory, but if anyone has any questions on the information that we've gone over, my contact information is up there on the slide, so feel free to reach out to me with your questions. And again, thanks.